my name is Maria Ma, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Victorian Ombudsman and a recent IPA Victoria board member. And it is in that capacity that I am hosting this episode of Public Sector Perspectives. To begin with, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. I recognise their continued connection to the land and waters and acknowledge that their sovereignty has never been ceded. I extend that acknowledgement and respect to any First Nations people listening to this recording. The aim of this episode is to raise the profile of IPA Victoria's most prestigious award, the Victorian Fellowship, and shine a spotlight on the leadership journey of the 2023 recipients. IPA Victoria Fellowship is awarded annually to individuals who have provided an outstanding and exemplary contribution to the sector, demonstrated inclusive leadership and broader support for the sector, and alignment with IPA Victoria values. In December 2023, IPA Victoria recognised 6 Victorian Fellows, 1 National Fellow, and an IPA Life Member. Today, I am joined by one of those Fellows. Pam Anders is the Senior Executive Director, Mental Health and Wellbeing Transformation with the Department of Health. Pam has held senior leadership roles in the Victorian Public Service and community sector, with an abiding commitment to positive transformation and a passion for delivering meaningful change and growing greater public value for communities. In her current role, she is leading implementation of reform from the Royal Commission in Victoria's mental health system. Pam, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. That's quite an introduction to be humbled by. Thank you very much.
And congratulations on being awarded the IPA Victoria Fellowship. You have demonstrated an ongoing commitment to the Victorian community from starting as a graduate teacher, I understand, and all the way to today, as we said, as the Senior Executive Director, Mental Health and Wellbeing Transformation. So could you please share with our listeners your career journey?
Sure. Firstly, can I just say, look, it's been a real honour to have this recognition. I think many of us go into these roles not for the recognition, but for the opportunity, the impact. But I was very chuffed and very humbled, and also just a big congratulations to the other Fellows, IPA Fellows of 2023. It was quite a group to stand with, so a real thrill. Thank you. My career journey, yes, as you said, I did start as a graduate teacher. I guess like most, was like many others, you know, I had some exposure in my secondary school years to some really amazing teachers, and that really motivated me to want to do that. And I focused for a couple of years as a secondary school teacher, focusing on legal studies and civics education. And I think in hindsight now, that was really a bit of a segue moment for me, because I was so motivated by getting other people to be motivated about what you can do and how to be an active citizen in society. It was really just the beginning, I guess, of a longer career journey in trying to drive impact and be a really active citizen myself, but as a professional and working as a public servant. So I started also I was lucky to be recruited into the graduate recruitment scheme of the Victorian government. And that was a great learning kind of step up program in terms of peers and support. And since then, I've been really blessed, I guess, to work in and around government for pretty much the last 25 years, whether that's been in central agencies as a senior bureaucrat, in statutory authorities, at WorkSafe, outside of government, working for Oxfam Australia in the international development space, and more recently back with government within the Department of Health. So I feel like I've probably enjoyed and tried to contribute as much as possible from a whole range of perspectives around government. But I think I guess my other reflection is the common thread through each of those moves and my career journey has been, I think, that combination of purpose and people that you work with and learn from, and also the opportunity to really have impact at scale.
I think for me, what really stands out is that reference to impact as one of the key common threads for you. And I would love to come back to that point later on. But I'm really interested in your work following the Royal Commission in Victoria's mental health. That report outlined 65 recommendations. I'm sure our listeners would agree it was a landmark report. Being involved in it, what can we learn from that report? And how can leaders support good mental health and well-being?
There's a lot to learn from the deliberations of the Royal Commission. I think the Royal Commission into Victoria's mental health system was quite unique in that it really did embrace some widespread engagement and participation, I think, from many people and organisations and leaders. I think, and we know this now post-COVID, but pre-COVID, when the Royal Commission's inquiry was underway, you know, mental health was not normalised. But we also knew that almost everyone was impacted by mental health, whether it was as an individual or as a carer or family or a friend. We all understand, you know, now what mental ill health looks like. And so I do think one of the, I think, most exciting things to come from the Royal Commission, the way in which they went about it, was really coming out with it. Mental health is everyone's business. Yes, of course, government plays a very significant role in that, both state and Commonwealth level, in, you know, providing access to, you know, treatment, care and support options. But the Royal Commission also looked at what's the role of local communities, what's the role of local government, what's the importance of social connection and family as that first tier of support. It also looked at settings like schools and workplaces and just how important they are to nurturing that really good mental health, but also being there to recognise where early interventions can be made to support better health of individuals. So I think there's a lot for people to take away, not just for those who work in the sector, but whether you're, you know, a local football coach and understanding the role that you can play in terms of mentoring young people and being that role model, whether you work at a primary healthcare network and understanding what the systems is and how your services work in, or whether you're at the pointy end, I guess, where, you know, most of my team's efforts is around looking at the, particularly the very complex care that needs to be provided to, you know, a cohort of Victorians.
I really like your point that the mental health responsibility is not at the front line, which is where you are, but it really sits with all of us individually and collectively. And the other point that you made that really resonated with me, that I'm just keen to get your sense of it now. Do you think that the mental health is normalised now?
I think it's come a long way. I don't want to underestimate the work we have ahead of us as a society and government to really reduce what is a very, you know, is the reality for some around ongoing stigma or discrimination because of mental ill health that people face, whether it's in workplaces or in society or local communities. But I don't want to underestimate how far we've come. I worked at WorkSafe almost 10 years ago, and part of my role there was designing and setting up a statewide public health early prevention and promotion program. And as part of that, we wanted to introduce kind of very simple kind of mental health risk screening tools to enable workplaces to identify work health risks or prevention opportunities earlier on, before they realised as a kind of occupational health and safety issue. But it was met with much resistance from employers and employees. If I reflect back on that time, a lot of suspicion from employees about how would my data and information be used in terms of an employment context. For employers, a real reluctance or perhaps a bit of a blind spot about understanding what their role was in promoting good mental health, not just in the workplace, about the workplace, but recognizing the whole person and what we bring. And I think about how we look at good mental health in workplaces now. That's no longer a debate. You know, it is very normalized in that respect. But that doesn't mean we've got a job ahead of us in terms of reducing stigma and discrimination.
I hear you loud and clear, still a long way to go. And I think that that's a really neat segue to thinking about our First Nations people and the impact of the reforms on them. What advice would you have to public sector professionals regarding supporting the First Nations social and emotional well-being and improving accessibility for a range of different diverse communities, but first and foremost the First Nations communities?
It's a good question, and if I may, I'd like to tackle it in two parts, because I think there's a common arch to that around how you ensure culturally safe and responsive services, whether you are a First Nations person or you come from a culturally linguistic background or LGBTQI plus community member. I think working with our First Nations people, and the Royal Commission was really clear about the importance of adopting an Aboriginal emotional and social wellbeing kind of model of care in how we develop, make sure mainstream services are culturally safe, but also community controlled organisations have accessible services and First Nations have choice, you know, whether it's working with a community controlled organisational service or a mainstream service. I think the advice I would have is be led by those First Nation voices. You know, it's very clear in Victoria we work within a self-determined determination framework that, you know, is both brings opportunity but also learnings in terms of what that means to work within a self-determination framework. But the vision is very clear when you look at Aboriginal social emotional wellbeing around self-determination is respected and upheld, that physical and emotional and social and spiritual aspects of health and wellbeing are seen and understood and to be connected. And I think we've got a lot to learn from those Aboriginal ways of knowing and being when we look at more broadly our healthcare system and our models of care. So be led by First Nations, work within a self-determination framework, and build trust in order to be led that way. If I can touch briefly just on the question around, I guess, accessible services for diverse communities, I think there's some very common threads there around, again, engaging in those voices of communities, being led by those voices, understanding the diverse perspectives that need to be understood and therefore designed to ensure that you've got really culturally safe and responsive practices or services.
And what's really coming out in that answer, Pam, for me is that one size cannot fit all, and the model really needs to be fit for purpose for different individuals and for different needs, different and varied needs of different communities. So recognizing that the Victoria's Mental Health and Wellbeing Act commenced on the 1st of September 2023. Can you share with our listeners what does that really mean? What are the key changes, and what can organisations and the employers do to get ready and to implement the changes in the Act?
Thanks for highlighting that. It's been a significant focus of the first couple of years of reform program to have this new act in place. And it does update previous acts, which do set down the legislative and regulatory functions for how state public specialist mental health and wellbeing services are operated. I think some of the really key, I think, changes in this Act are to update the Act to include things like a statement of recognition of Aboriginal people and acknowledgement of the treaty process. It enshrines legislative that commitment to Aboriginal self-determination for the first time. The Act also focuses on human rights and has a set of principles that really go to the heart of what the Royal Commission's recommendations to government was and its vision around having a more compassionate mental health and wellbeing system for all. So, for example, the principles guide how services who are publicly funded by Victoria, how they need to deliver, assess and treat and support, but also the kind of safeguard rights that consumers have. It also sets out, I guess, requirements for service providers to make reasonable or all reasonable efforts to comply with those principles and to give proper consideration of those principles. It sets up a range of, I think, really important new entities in the overall governance, new governance of the system in Victoria, such as an independent mental health and wellbeing commission, which amongst many of its functions now has, now families and carers have the right to take complaints to the new Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission. So I think it enshrines for the first time rights for families and carers alongside strengthening those rights for consumers to make complaints about the service they've provided with or if a service provider hasn't complied with those obligations in the Act. There's a lot more in the Act, but I think that's probably what I'm most excited about is the how we're enshrining those principles. And I encourage all providers to not just understand the legislative compliance required, but how those principles drive cultural change in the way in which they engage and deliver treatment, care, and support in their organisations.
And what really resonated, well, one of the many things that resonated with me in your response there is we are touching yet again on that theme of needing to normalise mental health, conversations about mental health and mental health issues. Let's go back to where we started. You and your leadership journey and your, you know, lovely answer at the beginning around one of your key drivers clearly is an opportunity and the need to make impact in everything you do. As a people leader, how would you describe your leadership style? And how do you approach decision-making in relation to risk management, policy, and strategic context?
There's a lot in that question. Let me give it a crack. Perhaps you might need to test with other people how what my leadership is like, but I have, I do strive to be collaborative and open and approachable. I also strive to be very clear and decisive in the work that we do. And I seek regular feedback from the people that I work with. I think it's who I work with and how we work has always been something that's really driven me, not just the what I'm doing. But I also think people's leadership styles adapt and change. I may have answered this question very differently 10 years ago, and maybe I'll answer it differently in 10 years' time. But that's, I guess, how I want to focus my attributes of leadership on at the moment. In response to your second question, how do I approach decision making in relation to kind of risk management, policy, and strategic concepts? I mean, I have, I guess, a few, I guess, tenets that I try to follow in terms of making good decisions and approaching decision making, and these have been informed and nurtured through, exposure to leaders who I think have been great decision makers and others that have been not so great decision makers. But I do think good decisions are made by considering many different viewpoints. Consensus decision making is not always possible, but when you make a decision, you need to be properly informed about who you've engaged and whether you've engaged them in a meaningful way. I also like to approach decisions are made and informed by those closest to the action or the problem. And I think that's one of the more contemporary attributes of the public service about, no longer is the senior bureaucrat the person who must know it all and know all the answers. Actually, the problems and the solutions to the really kind of complex issues we deal with are often found by those closest to the problem. I think also around approaches to decision about being very clear about accountability in terms of whose decision this is, the timeliness of a decision, because often there are trade-offs. If you need to make an urgent decision rather than a lot, you've got a long time frame. I think also how that decision is understood and communicated, whether it's internally to your people or to stakeholders or to the sector. I guess they're the kind of top things that come to me about when you pose that question about how to approach decision making.
And what really stood out for me in your answer there, Pam, is the extent to which you remain curious and open to learning, both as a leader in terms of your evolving leadership style, but also that inclusiveness about bringing those around you who might be far greater source of knowledge and wisdom than necessarily you as the leader. You also touched on the public service more broadly. Let me finish by asking you, as we said at the beginning, IPA Victoria's fellows are a distinguished cohort that can impart wisdom and advice to the public sector and the public purpose sector. So Pam, when it comes to your wisdom and advice for our audience, from your experience, what do you think makes an effective public servant?
It's a great question. Personally, I think curiosity, humility, and resilience makes an excellent public servant. I also think when you think about it in a leadership role, and I guess the role that we have as senior public servants around the stewardship of the public service, I read recently, and I hope he doesn't mind me kind of referencing him. He is an IPA fellow, Adam Fennessy, as I think he's currently a federal department secretary, where he said something recently in an article that really resonated with me about how messy it is working in the public service, but how much he loved that. And that really jumped out to me. And he made this comment about it's the messiness and the chaos and that can be really difficult and at times challenging, but it's also ultimately the reward around, requiring constant innovation, being able to have strong creativity, curiosity, and robustness to decisions. So that really resonated with me when someone asked him a similar question. My only other reflections is really around, I guess, the opportunity to make the public service a really great, rewarding place to work. And I think one of the things that makes an effective public servant is not only the delivery of what you need to do in your role, but how you're stewarding and nurturing the next generation of public sector leaders.
And I think that has been very much recognised in your case with the IPA Victoria Fellowship. Well, Pam, haven't we covered a rich tapestry of the mental health reforms and your stewardship of them, your leadership and the broader impact that you have made on the public purpose sector? On the behalf of IPA Victoria and our audience, thank you very much for your well thought through responses and reflections.
Oh, thank you. And thanks for the opportunity. It's been really wonderful to have this time just to reflect and share. Thank you.
And thank you to our audience for listening to this podcast. To learn more about what the IPA Victoria is doing, including our upcoming events, please visit the IPA Victoria website on vic.ipa.org.au. That's vic.ipaa.org.au. You can also stay in touch with what IPA Victoria does by following them on LinkedIn at IPA Victoria or on Twitter at IPA Vic. This program is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. My name is Maria Ma, and thank you very much for listening.